Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm your host, Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with legendary custom knife maker, Peter Carey. Peter has been making spectacular and unique tactical and dress tactical folders since the very early days of the form. He's done numerous collaborations with other makers and with production companies like Spyderco and more recently Monterey Bay Knives, putting his gorgeous designs in reach for the everyday collector. In recent years, Peter has also put out his own production line, which I got a chance to check out at Blade Show a few weeks back. His designs vary, but I feel like I can always tell when I'm looking at a Peter Carey knife, which makes me very excited to talk to the man behind the blades. But before we get into it, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, and click the notification bell. While you're there, check out my knife close-up videos, Thursday Night Knives, our live stream, and other interviews with the great makers and personalities that make the knife world happen. And if you think what we do here is valuable and you want to help support the show while enjoying exclusive opportunities and content, you can do so by going to Patreon. Quickest way to get there is to head over to thenifejunkie.com/Patreon. That's thenifejunkie.com/Patreon.
Got a question or comment? Call the Knife Junkies listener line at 724-466-4487.
Peter, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you, sir.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah. So a couple of days back, you gave me a call, which was a nice surprise, and we just chatted a little. And I feel like I got to know a little bit about you. And one of the things that really fascinated me is that you were born and grew up in the golden age of Southern California in the 60s and 70s. And I have a real romantic notion about that time and place. So tell me about how you got involved in knife making. Did it start there?
In Southern California, you know, just like everybody else, you know, knife makers, we loved knives as kids, right? So, I collected knives. My older brother was a real influence on me, Richard. You know, we were allowed to carry knives back then in school, right? So I carried a little knife. In fact, I still have it, a little, Case Sod Buster. I can't believe I still have this thing from junior high, right? My brother gave me that in junior high. And, you know, so he kind of got me hooked on knives. My dad wasn't really into knives, but I remember he had a bayonet from World War II in the garage. And it was like, wow, this thing is just cool, you know?
Yeah.
But it was more my brother that got me into knives than anything else.
So was he, was your brother an influence in terms of using them, or was he a collector? Like, what was the lifestyle like then that you were carrying knives at school? I can't even imagine it.
Everybody carried knives back then, you know. In the '60s and the '70s, it was normal for a kid to have a knife in his pocket. It wasn't any big deal. I mean, we were about an hour east of LA, kind of out in the country. You know, it was all orange groves, citrus groves, and vineyards, and kids just had knives. And my brother always carried a knife. You know, he was a Vietnam vet, and he came back and he always had a Puma folding knife, like the Buck 110.
Right.
I think it was called a Game Master or something. But he always had one of those in his back pocket, and he would actually take those because he thought they were too thick, and he would grind the handles down. Right. And the bolster that had brass bolsters, he would grind them way thinner than they came from the factory. And so I don't know if that influenced me that, you can take something and modify it. But, you know, he did that to all his knives.
Man, that's an interesting idea, because I have, I have a Buck 110 and a 112, and I've always loved them and always kind of regretted the fact that I never carry them, because they are like boat anchors and you got to have them on your in a sheath on your belt. Maybe that's a good idea. Just grind it down.
Well, I never liked the little leather sheath, you know, on your belt. So I always liked it in my pocket instead. But, you know, that wasn't really handy either, you know, in your back pocket. This is another knife that my brother gave me. It's a Puma. I can't remember what model it is. But I used to carry this in my left back pocket. And it's really the first knife that I ever modified. It's not highly modified, but I was actually riding my motorcycle to work. I worked at a gas station in high school, and this old lady pulled out in front of me and then saw me and stopped, right, blocking the road. So I laid my motorcycle over and slid around the front end of her, and I was, you know, riding on top of the motorcycle, laid over, and sliding on my butt. Well, this knife, I was sliding on this knife, and it ripped a hole in my back pocket, and the knife fell out, and I didn't realize it till I got to work, right? And so after work, it was dark, and so I was out there with a flashlight trying to find my knife on the road, and I found it, but it was all scratched up, and the little Puma emblem that went right in there, I don't know if you can see the little black circle, it was gone. So, you know, I took some black crap and filled it up and then ground it and got rid of all the scratches and stuff. And so that was kind of, you know, the first knife that I modified. I figured if my brother could do it, I could do it too.
Jeez, man. Looking at that knife and then looking at the knives that you make today, you've come quite a ways.
I'm just surprised that I still have these knives from that long ago. You know, obviously I cherished them because, you know, my brother gave them to me.
It's also safe to say that that knife saved your butt, quite literally.
Yeah, it did. It really did. It really did. I've always had knives since I was a kid, you know, and what really got me back into knives is, I guess it was in the early 80s, a guy I worked with, another welder, right, gave me a Spyderco worker. And I actually still have this thing. If you look at the blade, it's like all ground up because I used it for everything. But this knife, like, totally changed everything for me. You know, Sal Glesser with the pocket clip was the biggest thing. You know, I wasn't that impressed with the hole, but the pocket clip. No longer did I have to keep it in my pocket or keep it in a sheath. I could clip it to my pocket. And it was like, that was awesome.
Yeah, because there's that feeling of having a knife free floating in your pocket. You get about maybe a minute or two with it standing, you know, north to south, which is the comfortable position, and then you walk, and eventually, it rides, you know,
east
to west, and you're constantly readjusting that, and to have a clip is a revelation.
Yeah, it was mind blowing to me. You know, it's like a pocket clip, you know, because I always carried a measuring tape around with a clip on. It's like, it just made so much sense to have a knife with a clip on, right?
So you were a welder by trade from early on?
Yeah, like right after high school, I went to college, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I knew I could weld because I welded in junior high and in high school and in shop classes, and I liked it because I got to burn stuff. And I got in a lot of trouble in school and shop classes, and I actually got kicked out of wood shop for setting the building on fire. it's a long story, but me and another guy got in trouble for catching the building on fire. And so Mr. Allman, the shop teacher for woodshop, permanently banned me from woodshop. So metal shop it was, right? Metal shop and welding and all that. And, you know, I got in a lot of trouble in metal shop too, but they didn't kick me out. You know, we used to take the little, we used to do brazing, and they had the little container with flux in it. Oh. And so instead of opening the whole lid, they drill a hole in it so you could just dip the rod in there, heat the rod, dip it in the flux, right? Well, nobody was looking. I'd take the oxygen acetylene torch and put a little oxygen acetylene in that hole. And the next guy that put that hot rod in it, it would blow up, right? And the lid would hit. And I'd just be looking around like, what the heck? I didn't do it. But yeah, luckily I didn't get kicked out of metal shop because that's what I decided to do. You know, after high school, it was like, well, I don't know what I want to do, but I can weld. I need to make some money. So I got certified as a welder and started working in a steel fab shop, fabricating structural steel. So I did that for, 6 years before I started my own company.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you were telling me that. And you would go into already existing structures and shore them up for earthquakes and that kind of thing?
We did everything. I mean, we did brand new construction of, you know, businesses, custom houses, aircraft control towers, bridges. We rebuilt the, like after that Northridge earthquake, we did a lot of the work on retrofitting the columns that hold those bridges up. the columns were made out of concrete with rebar in them. And what we were doing was wrapping them in steel. And so they'd come in two halves and, you know, they'd wrap them and we'd do full pin welds on both sides all the way up. And some of those things were, you know, 80 foot tall. So it was pretty good work.
It sounds like the concrete column itself could eventually fall away, but it'd still stand because of that that outer structure.
Yeah.
So how did this, was it the welding that led you? I mean, you already had a love of knives, well established, inspired by your brother and the bayonet in the garage. did the working with metal and welding, how did it come about that you started to make these fine knives?
Well, you know, again, being totally interested in knives and guns and stuff, when my jobs would get rained out or whatever, on the way home, I'd stop by the gun shop, right, and talk to the guys and look at guns that I wanted to buy. And they had a knife in there that was just like a blank, right, that you could buy and you can go finish it yourself. So, you know, my job was rained out. It was raining. I couldn't do anything. And so I bought one of those blanks. And I took it home and I had some wood laying around and I made a handle for it and put it together. And I didn't make a sheath for it, but you know, I made this knife, right? I didn't have to grind it. It was already heat treated and everything. I just made a handle for it. I was like, wow, that was pretty cool. But I want to go farther than that. I want to grind and actually make a knife, right? But before I, you know, bought all the tooling and everything, I already had a drill press. I made this knife with a file.
Whoa.
Check that thing out. Yeah, this is actually the very first knife I made 100% on my own.
Wow.
With that a file.
That is nice. Right? It looks like a sort of like a loveless dagger there.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I kept that. I never made a sheath for it either. It was just like, I took a lot of work, you know, files and sandpaper and you know, all that stuff.
So you didn't have a grinder at this point. You
were no, but after I did that, it was like, all right, I'm going to buy a grinder. And I'm going to buy, you know, the minimum stuff I needed to make a knife. So I started making, you know, small fixed blades. On one of our vacations, I ended up getting a magazine at one of the stores. And it had an article in there on these guys that made neck knives, right? Small fixed blade neck knives. And one of the guys was Bud Neely. Right. I don't know if you know who Bud Neely is.
Oh, I sure do.
He made some really cool small fixed blades. And it's like, man, I want to be able to do that. So when we got back, there was a knife show in Solvang, California. And we drove up there and I bought my first custom knife from Bud Neely.
Nice. Right?
So I was like, okay, I can make one of these. So you know, I've got all the equipment and you know, started making some fixed blades. Here's this is a real early. I made this for my dad, uh-huh. Right?
Oh,
and,
cool.
and I just recently found it in my dad's tackle box. My dad passed away in 2006, right? So I got a bunch of his stuff and I was looking through his old tackle box and it's like, wow, here's this knife, right? Cool. I forgot that I made it. You know, I went back then. I was making knives, and I was just giving them away to friends and contractors, and just giving them away. I wasn't selling them. You know, I didn't think they were worth selling, right?
So, what year is this about? You saw the Bud Neelys, and you started making your own.
I made this first one in 97. Mm-hmm. So I made fixed blades from 97 to 2000. 2000, I made my first folder.
Okay, so tell me, describe or explain that transition. It seems like a daunting one to go from fixed blades, which have no mechanism, no mechanical aspect to them, to a folder. How did that happen and what inspired it?
Well, this knife right here inspired it. I don't know if you're familiar with this knife. It's a Spyderco, right? It's a collaboration with Mr. Terzola, right? So I bought this knife, right? And it's like, who's this guy, right? Who is this guy? Oh, he's a custom knife maker. Custom knife maker. Custom folder maker. All right, cool. So then he came out with that book, the Tactical Folding Knife, right? And I bought that book, and it's like, it had all the answers I needed to make a folder, you know, with a liner lock. And so I started working on that and followed. I mean, my book, I got this book, right? It's dirty and crap. I followed everything that he said in that book on how to make a folder. And, you know, the first ones were pretty rough, but it worked. So this right here is my first folder that I ever made. And it's kind of funky.
Wow.
Kind of trippy looking.
That looks great, man. That was your first folder.
That's my first folder.
Is that a frame lock?
Yeah, I guess you would call it a frame lock with some overlays, titanium overlay. Yeah, I don't know if you can see it there very good. But anyway, I gave it to a friend of mine that I worked with, and I told him to beat the crap out of it. And he beat the crap out of it, and he brought it back a few months later, and it was all tore up. And so I gave him another knife, and I refinished that, and I gave it to my dad. And so my dad had it, you know, until he passed away, and I got it back.
So that's how you got it back.
And so did you find yourself, I tell people this sometimes just as a matter of reference, but I have made a few knives in the shed out back, you know, and they take me forever, and they're fixed blades, and they're, you know, they're cool as far as I'm concerned. I send them to someone else to heat treat. They take me forever. And to me, it's challenging enough. I mean, I can't believe your first knife was a dagger. To me, that blows my mind, because it's like you couldn't have picked a harder fixed blade.
Yeah, no kidding.
Was there a challenge there to go into the folders that really pulled you in?
Not really the challenge. It was, I just wanted to make folders. I love folders. You know, I've been carrying folders since I was a kid, right? So that's really what I wanted. You know, don't get me wrong. I like fixed blades, but folders was always my desire. So, I mean, that's really what I wanted to make.
Well, then how did you go from these folders, like the ones you've been carrying and using, to these beautifully dressed up exotic material pieces?
Years and years of work, I guess. You know, originally I didn't want to work with any of those fancy materials. And I told a lot of guys that, you know, there's some collectors that know me from early on that, no, I didn't want to work with any of that. I wanted to make tactical folders that were users, right? But, you know, eventually you got to do it, right? Eventually somebody wants something fancy, and then it's kind of a challenge. Okay, I got to try that. I got to do it. So, and then, you know, once people see that and they like it, that's what they start ordering, you know? They start ordering the fancy stuff. Not only because they like it, but I think because they can sell it for more down the road. Right.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, when I first started taking orders, I worked part time. I mean, it was just basically a hobby until I moved out here to Texas. Right. I started selling a few knives in 2000. We moved out here in 2006, but I wasn't really trying to make any money, you know, when I was in California. It was just a hobby when I had time to do it. And if I could make a few bucks, I'd do it. My first folder that I sold was to my mechanic. Right. Fixed my trucks, you know, every time they broke down. So he was like my first customer to buy a folder.
So those first folders that were usable and sturdy. I mean, not that the other ones aren't sturdy, but to me, like your more artsy, artful, exotic material folders look like things that I wouldn't want to test to see how sturdy they are. Obviously you're making them in the same, you know, it's the same guy making them, right?
Yeah, and they're still built strong. You know, the materials, you know, well, you know, like Timascus, it's fancy, but it's not fragile. It's a tough material. It's titanium, right? I mean, it's tough stuff. So really the only, you know, fragile materials are like, you know, mammoth ivory and stuff like that. Right. Damascus, it's tough material, you know? So, I mean, you can beat the crap out of it. It's just going to cost you a lot of money to get it refinished. Right.
It's just going to look good doing it.
I don't refinish knives for free anymore. You know, I used to do that as a service, but people would take advantage of it. And, you know, they'd carry them and show them off and beat the crap out of them. They send them back to you, and you spend hours, you know, cleaning them back up and send them back to them. And next thing you know, it's for sale. and for a lot of money. You know, more money than you sold it for, and you're not getting anything for, you know, refurbing it. So I started charging to do refurbs.
So how did you break into, what was the knife, and tell me what it was like when you became sort of known for making these kind of pieces?
The Nitro, the full-size Nitro, before it was a flipper, when it was just a thumb stud knife. This is the knife that really got me off the ground. When I first moved to Texas, I set up my shop and screwed off a lot, because I was just so burnt out from being a contractor for, 20 something years. I spent a lot of time fishing and golfing and hunting and shooting and, just enjoying life while I slowly set up my shop. And I ended up making, 3 Nitros, and I put them on the USN, right? Way back when, 2007, I think it was 2006, maybe. And, this guy, hits me up and he goes, "Well, I want to buy one, but I don't know which one I want." 'Cause they all three of them had different handle material.
Right.
And, I go, "All right, that sounds good. Get back to me when you make up your mind." Right. Well, he didn't get back to me for a day or so. And another guy, calls me up and he goes, "I want all 3. I'm like, "All right, sell all 3 right now." And so, I sold all 3 to this guy. I don't want to name names, but this other guy calls me up and he goes, "Okay, I've made up my mind. I want this one." It's already sold. He got pissed, right?
Snooze, you lose.
And so we went back and forth, and we ended up becoming really good friends. He's a good friend of mine. He's a good collector, and he'll know when he listens to this who he is. But he's a real good guy, and he's got a pretty good collection of my knives. But it's one of them things where it could have turned into an argument where you hate each other, but you work it out, right?
So it was that Nitro that really pushed you. Is that a 4 inch blade? About a 4 inch blade?
3¾, so just under 4 inch.
Okay. Yeah.
And so then I started getting orders. My wife told me, and she goes, "Well, when we moved out to Texas," she goes, "what are you going to do for a living?" And I go, "Well, because we came out here with nothing, right? No jobs lined up, not knowing anybody. I mean, we just sold everything in California and moved out here." And I told her that, I want to try being a knife maker, to make a living at it. She goes, "I give you 2 years to be successful." Right? So, the pressure's on, right? And so, I took a year's worth of orders, and I gave people prices. I gave people dates, which is just crazy, I realized, right? Yeah. But this is the first time taking orders, right? Before, I would just make what I wanted and sell it if somebody wanted to buy it. So I struggled through that year, and I met those dates and I met those prices, even though, as my popularity was going up, obviously the prices needed to be going up and price of material were going up. So I kept taking orders, but I stopped giving dates and prices, because everybody was also changing their mind on what they wanted, right? Mm-hmm. And so I took probably 5, 6, 7 years worth of orders, which was just really stupid, honestly. But I had to show my wife, right? I had to show Olivia that, look, I got all these orders. I got all this work lined up. I can do this. I can make some money at this, right?
So you had 5 or 7 years worth of orders. Did it take you 5 to 7 years to go through those first ones?
I'm still working on it. Honestly, I've obviously added names since then, and I actually stopped taking orders. It got to the point where I had to stop taking orders, but I started doing shows, right? Uh-huh. And I took those orders, not ever planning on doing shows. I didn't want to do shows. I didn't want to be that guy, because I'd gone to knife shows before. Mm-hmm. You see the guy sitting there, and nobody talks to him, and nobody looks at his knives, and you feel sorry for the guy, right? And I did not want to be that guy. I was not going to be that guy. So I didn't want to do shows, right? And so there's a dealer, Mark Strauss, Mark. So he was asking me, "Hey, you want to do a show?" And I'm like, "No, I really don't want to do a show." She goes, "What if I can get you into the TKI? And I'm thinking, "Yeah, right. TKI, right." So, I go, "If you can get me into the TKI, I'll do the TKI." Next thing you know, he's got me lined up to do TKI. And I'm like, "Oh, man, I'm not ready for this." Because these are like the top guys, right? My first knife show as an exhibitor is going to be the TKI. And I'm like, man, I was stressed out. So that was in Vegas. That one when Ed Wormser still ran that show. And it was at the Palms, Right? I don't know if you're familiar with the Palms in Vegas. But it was at like the very top floor. And so we went up there and I go in the room and there's, you know, canned onions in there. And Bob Terzola is in the table right beside me. Yinz Anzo's on the other side. And I'm like, man, I do not belong in this room. I do not belong in this room. But, you know, Bob Terzola, right? Bob Terzola book. Bob Terzola is right beside me. Right. So I walk over to Bob. I'm looking at his knives. I introduce myself. And he's going, well, let's go over and look at your knives. Bob Terzola's going to look at my knives. Right. So that, I mean, that was just totally cool. He's just a gentleman. He comes over and he looks at all of them and he goes, man, they're really nice. They're really well made. And so that took a little bit of pressure off. Right. I didn't feel too. But
you taught me well, Bob.
Yeah, I still felt like I didn't belong there, you know. But
let me ask you a question. TKI is Tactical Knife Invitational, right?
Yeah. So you got to be invited. You have to get into that show.
Okay. All right. That's
so usually it's like it used to be like 20 makers, and then like 250 collectors, and that's it. Once they got that room full with 250, there's no more. Right.
Wow.
And limited makers. And so, you know, it's kind of an exclusive deal. And, you know, they serve you drinks, they give you dinner. I mean, it's really a nice show. You know,
it's the high rollers show.
Yeah. It's in the evening and it's always been, you know, one of my favorite shows, not because it was my first show, but it's just a really good way to do a knife show. You know, you don't got to sit there behind a table for 2 or 3 days, like, you know, Blade Show 3 days. Like, God, it's terrible.
So it's kind of assumed if you're invited to TKI, there's a market for your work, and there will most likely, there's obviously no guarantees, but there will most likely be buyers there for your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not so much of a, it seems like maybe it's not so much of a competitive thing because people who want a Bob Terzola are going to show up there to get a Bob Terzola. People who want a Peter Carey are going to show up there to get a Peter Carey.
And it's all lottery. Every piece on everybody's table is lottery. You can't just go in there and go, I want to buy that. You got to be chosen the right to buy that, right? Or open bids, right? So, you know, everything sells pretty much at every TKI. I've never seen a TKI where, you know, anybody had knives left on the table.
I wonder if they want someone like myself to cover it sometime. That, I mean, it's,
sure.
It sounds like a fascinating place to be a fly on the wall, you know, if you don't have, you know, if you're not invited. It seems like it'd be a cool thing to experience.
Well, you can always buy a ticket. It's a few $100.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see about that. Maybe a couple of years from now. Yeah. So, you go to your first TKI and what was the response? How did you do? How many knives did you take? What was your experience like there?
I'm not sure how many knives I took. I think at that time they didn't want you to bring any more than 8 knives. And so I'd have to look it up. I brought anywhere from 6 to 8 knives and the response was really good. I mean, everybody liked my work and like I said, everything sold. I've met a lot of nice people. I've met a lot of these knife makers that I've seen online and on the forums for forever. And it's like, wow, these guys are real, you know, being able to go over and, you know, talk to Ken Onion and, you know, like I said, Bob Terzola, it was like pretty awesome.
So after that experience, that seems like maybe that was your catapult into the kind of upper stratosphere with your work. Then how did that permit you to work from then on? Was it did it turn into a different ball game for you, different grind, so to speak?
Yeah, people wanted fancier stuff. Right. Cause you know, you bring fancy stuff to the TKI. So I started making fancier knives and, me and my wife went to the Blade Show just as spectators for the first time that year. And, you know, talked to a lot of people, met a lot of people. And, we were at the booth where Tom Mayo and Jeremy Guinness and Matt Cucciera was and was talking to those guys. And Matt and Jerry asked me if I wanted to share the booth with them next year. Right. And I'm like, yeah, all right. This knife show thing ain't too bad, right? I can do that. So we did that booth for quite a few years with those guys, and I mean, we had a blast at that show. We'd have we'd have big crowds. We'd do lotteries and you know, me and Jerry would do it like right after another, and we'd have, you know, a ton of people. You know, Blade Show would get mad at us and say we're causing a fire hazard. We need to take it outside. And it's like, well, what are we going to do? You know, that's why we're paying for a booth, right? Right. So we can have all these people right here.
Yeah.
But we had some good times in that booth. It was a lot of fun, even though it was 3 days long and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I was so thrilled with my experience there. This was my first time, as I mentioned to you before. And part of me, I can't believe it was my first time. I felt like I belonged there, you know, just in that sea of knives. I could not get enough. So fast forward to, you know, now, in terms of how you work, what's your process like?
Well, it depends on if I'm doing orders or if I'm prepping for a show. You know, if I'm prepping for a show, I make what I want to make, what I think that is going to go good at the show. And that also depends on the show. You know, TKI, I'll bring fancier knives. Like when I was working Blade Show, and I haven't done Blade Show since 2017. So it's been a few years. Blade Show, I would bring a lot more knives. You know, I might bring 20 knives to Blade Show. And I'd bring a variety of, you know, a few fancy, a few mid-grade, and then, you know, maybe some 50-50s or, you know, semi-production knife, you know. Try and have a price point for everybody. Right.
Right.
And then, like, you know, the gathering, it's more of a tactical folder show, I think. So, you know, the gathering in Vegas, I'll do a few fancy knives and then some more frame locks, because those guys all love frame locks, even though to me, I really don't care for frame lock. Right. To me, a frame lock is a lazy knife. Right.
Why?
It's the easiest knife to make. Right. and I think that's why so many people make them, because they're super easy to make.
Wait,
less parts, right? There's less parts. Uh-huh. So they're a lot easier to make than, you know, ones with bolsters and inlays and all that, right? Less work, less parts. But people love the heck out of them. But you'll notice sometimes on my Instagram when I show a frame lock, I'll do hashtag lazy. Not on everyone. And, you know, some people get it, some people don't. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to think I'm an ass for saying that, but. Man, it's the truth. You know, a frame lock is so much easier to make than, you know, folders with bolsters and inlays and all that stuff.
So the knife at the top, Jim, if you could scroll back up to the top. Thank you, sir. That one in the center at the very top, I saw a number of shots of that.
Yeah.
And I just absolutely adore that knife. What is that? Is that the Scion?
It's a Scion, yeah. It's a Scion with a blue twill G10, which is some old blue twill G10 from, man, maybe 10 years ago. Maybe 8 years ago. I don't think you can get it anymore. I always try and save a little bit of those materials. But a lot of times that stuff goes out of favor. You know, like silver twill. A lot of people don't like silver twill. I like silver twill. So I still got silver twill. And I'll make a knife every once in a while with it. And people haven't seen it for a while. And they go, oh, wow, that's cool. Right? It's just like that material. When was the last time you saw that material? Right? It's been a long time, right?
Yeah.
So I'll pull out a little piece out of my shelf of materials and go, I'm going to make a knife out of that. I haven't done that for
show
a while.
Them.
Right? Yeah.
So you were talking about, you've mentioned 50-50 knives a couple of times. Is that like what you call a mid-tech? You know, you have some of it made elsewhere. And
yeah. You know, the reason why I call it a 50-50 is because I figured 50% of it is machined in somebody else's shop.
Okay.
And I do the other 50% by hand, you know, hand ground blade, fitting the lock in the detent and all that. And so I didn't want to call it a production. The mid-tech was getting kind of confusing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my thing was call it a 50-50.
Okay. So this brings me back to my process question. I was reading your webpage and you said everything is handmade from manual machines. So that means exactly what? As a non-knife maker, I have my own ideas about it, but what do you mean by that?
That means I take material and I cut it out with a bandsaw or a plasma cutter. Even though I do use a water jet cutter on some of my models, I do have some parts water jet cut out now. Mm-hmm. Early on when my son still lived at home, you know, through junior high and high school, he was my bandsaw guy, right? So he would cut out my parts and drill holes and tap holes and do all that. Well, when he went off to college, right, I kind of lost that guy, right? But now I needed to make more money to pay for his college, right? So it made sense to start getting stuff water jet cut out to take his place. So, you know, I started doing that. So a lot of my knives have water jet, you know, frames and blades, but I still do everything else and all that still has to be ground, you know?
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it's done.
Well, okay. So let me ask you this, the actual mechanics of it and getting the lock and the tang, you know, the lock face and the tang and everything to fit up just right. Each time you make a new knife or design a new knife, do you have to reinvent the wheel or do you come up with sort of a recipe that works and go from there?
After you do it for a while, you kind of know where the detent needs to be and where the stop pin needs to be. But it changes, you know, depending on the size of the knife, right? It's a lot easier to work out all that, those little details on a bigger knife than it does a smaller knife. The smaller knives are harder to get all that stuff, you know, because there's less room. But yeah, every time you design a knife, you can kind of use, you know, what you've done in the past to give you an idea where all that stuff should line up. But like I said, it's easier on a bigger knife. There's just more room, you know?
Yeah.
But I draw everything up on paper. You know, I don't know how to do CAD. I wish I did. I need to learn how to do CAD. So, you know, I draw everything up by hand on paper. And, you know, if it looks good, I'll make a copy of it. I'll put it down. Then I'll redraw it, you know, and, oh, okay, that looks good. I'll make a copy of it. And then I'll redraw it. And then I'll look at all, you know, three or four. And, oh, okay, well, I like this one the best, right? And then I'll take that and I'll cut the paper out. Or I'll make more copies of it, right? And I'll cut the paper out and I'll glue that paper onto some G10 and I'll cut that out and I'll drill the holes and see if it opens and closes and all that stuff. And then I'll start making the knife out of real materials.
I got to say, I love that. I love hearing when people do everything on paper with, you know, paper and pencil. I'm, you know, I live in the modern world. I have a job using modern equipment and that kind of thing, but I still, you know, I still love my notebooks and I love my paper and I love to draw and sketch and stuff. And I love to hear that something so precise and so functional and beautiful, like your knives, for instance, can start from a drawing on paper. And it doesn't have to be in the CAD world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I took drafting in junior high, believe it or not, you know, and I wish they had CAD back then, but they didn't, you know. Or I would have learned that and I'd be doing CAD right now. But, hand drawings, you know, I'm going to learn CAD one of these days. I need to. But right now I just, you know, haven't had time.
Okay. To what end do you want to learn CAD? Is that so you can make your designs, get them in the CAD world and then send them out to manufacturers? Or is that so you can streamline your own process in your own shop by getting a CNC or something like that?
Yeah, that's the plan for the future. I'd love to be able to, you know how to program a CNC machine and do all that. You know, I'm getting old, man. I'm 61 years old and, you know, my neck's all jacked up and my wrist and everything. You know, I'm not in the greatest shape anymore. And so, you know, bending over grinding all day does not do me any good. So if I can have a CNC machine that I can program to cut out some of the parts, you know, I'm still going to do the majority of the work. I'm still going to hand grind the blades, but it would make life easier on my hands and my wrists and my neck, you know, if the machine was over here doing some work, right? Instead of me, cause I'm not going to hire employees, you know, I've done that before in the, you know, contractor world and it's no fun having employees.
Yeah. And then you have to worry about them making your knives that carry your name. Right.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that's a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to pump out, you know, hundreds of knives a month. I'm not really worried about that. I'm just having fun, you know, and making some money at the same time. You know, I am so thrilled that I can make stuff that I enjoy making and somebody is willing to pay me for it. You know, I mean, that is the coolest thing. You know, I enjoy what I do. I go down to my shop and by myself. I used to be with my dog, but my dog died. Oh. I haven't got another dog. I haven't replaced my dog yet. But, you know, I turn on the music and I'm in my own little world. You know? And the day goes by and it's nice. And, you know, if it's a really nice day out and I feel like going fishing in the morning, I'll take my kayak and go out fishing for a couple hours and then come back in and work in the shop for the rest of the day. You know,
I've seen those pictures. That's pretty awesome.
So, I mean, you know, it's pretty nice. You know, compared to what I did in California, don't get me wrong, I love being a contractor. Mm-hmm. I worked all over Southern California. I did a lot of really cool jobs. I could be down on the beach in Malibu one day, you know, building a custom house on the beach. I could be up in the mountains the next day, or I could be in the city working on a school. You know, I was all over the place, and I did that for 25 years, and that was really cool. I enjoyed it. But, you know, it started getting so hectic with traffic, more and more people moving there. And then, you know, the job sites changed also with, you know, the jobs were more coordinated. You know, everybody knew whose job came first and they stayed out of each other's way. You know, it was chaos on the job sites and it got really frustrating, you know. And then, you know, you get the framers in. We're doing steel frame and they attach wood frame to the steel frame. Right. And so, you know, you'd have these guys come in and they're not even supposed to be on the job yet because our welding has to be visually inspected. Then after it cools down, it has to be UT, ultrasound inspected. Mm-hmm. Right. So these guys are burying our work in wood. Right. So they're not even supposed to be on the job yet until it's inspected and signed off. And so, you know, they're running their air hose underneath us and hanging jackets on the threaded studs on our steel. Because it's a nice place to hang a jacket, but, you know, that's where they put the wood on, right? And so we're up in boom trucks welding above them, and you know our sparks go down or they catch their clothes on fire, wow. Right? And then they get mad at us, right? Well, you burnt my jacket. That was a $40 jacket. I want $40. And like, I'm not paying you $40. It's $40. You shouldn't have put your jacket there. Oh, you burnt our air hose. You know you got to buy us a new air hose. It's like you're supposed to be on the job yet, right?
Well, it seems pretty dangerous, especially on a job site, like a construction site like that. If people can't communicate with one another, I mean, it's dangerous as it is, but when you add, you know, machinery and tons of materials and tall structures to the recipe, it could just be a disaster. Yeah. It sounds a little bit like you got into the game. It sounds like you got into tactical knife folders and such. Like right at the right time too.
Yeah, that was very lucky that, you know, when I got in, it was like really when tactical folders were really taken off, you know.
At that point, when you first got into it, not as many fish in the sea as there are now.
Yeah.
It seems like the knife world is a big and thriving marketplace. What are your impressions of how the knife world has grown, or what are your feelings and thoughts on the explosion? It seems like an explosion to me, because I've been following it. I've been into knives my whole life, and it just seems like now there are so many people, so many makers, and you can be a maker, you know, with your hands. You can be a maker with CAD. You can be a designer.
CNC machine.
Yeah. You can be someone who just makes designs and sends it to
you.
A lot of different aspects to the knife making world. What are your feelings on how it's grown?
You know, there ain't nothing you can do about it, right? I mean, I guess it's good. It's more variety for the collectors, mm-hmm. right? Which is good. It's harder for custom knife makers to come up with something new that isn't looking like so and so's knife. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. the struggle. I have a lot of designs, but coming up with something new that doesn't fringe on somebody else's knife is getting harder and harder all the time.
What about infringing on your own designs? You know, since you really, like, you've been doing this a long time, and you know, I meant it up front when I said I feel like I can tell when I'm looking at one of your knives, and that's not because you keep redoing the same design. You certainly don't. But like any artist who's been around long enough, you've created a style all your own,
yeah.
you know, yeah. and it's the style that you recognize. are you ever in danger of cannibalizing your own style?
Probably. You know, I mean, you see traits like, you know, these look, you know, the handles look very similar, even though they're different, right? Yeah. You know, but they're very similar. So yeah, you use some design aspects that you like and that are known to you on some of your other knives. It's kind of hard not to, you know, because that's yours, right?
Yeah.
You know, so like I said, coming up with something new is pretty hard. You know, I come up with ideas a lot of times in the middle of the night. You know, I'll wake up and it's like, oh man, that'll be a cool knife. And try and get up and draw it out and then look around and see if anybody else has done something like that. That you're not just going, oh wow, that was a cool knife I saw and now it's not mine. Right. And now, oh wait, that's not mine.
It's like when you sit down with your guitar and you come up with the greatest Led Zeppelin riff ever. You know, oh, that's they already did that.
They already did it.
Yeah. So what tell me what it's been like working. You have a collaboration right now with Monterey Bay Knives. And you've had, which looks really awesome. I mean, well, I've only seen just a part of it, but I'm trying to extrapolate outward. And then you've also done stuff with Spyderco. What's it like going from being a maker who makes almost everything by hand, to going to giving a design and taking it completely out of your hands with a big company like Spyderco or Monterey Bay?
Yeah, it's different. Spyderco takes forever to get a knife going, right? And so a lot of times, you know, a knife that you give them, they'll put it in their case and they take it around the world, right, in that case. And if they get enough response for it, they'll make it, right? But sometimes that takes a year, right, or 2 years. And so, you know, sometimes that trend that knife was following is gone, right, by the time they get around to making it. But, you know, the other thing is, you know, they'll make a prototype and they'll send it to you and ask you for, you know, info. What do you think? You know, you give them what, you know, your critique, right? And sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't. And once the product's out, there ain't really much you can do about it if they didn't listen, you know? So that's a frustration. I'm sure everybody has it working with the big factories. But, you know, the mailbox money is nice. And, you know, the three knives that I designed with Spyderco, the Firefly, the Rubicon, and the Magnitude, you know, that money was coming in at the right time for me when my kid was in college. My youngest was in college. And, you know, it helped pay for his college. So I'm not going to complain about it.
That first Rubicon is actually the only one that I had personal experience with, a friend of mine at work. I love that knife.
Look at the polish on that carbon.
Ah, it's so beautiful. It feels so good in hand, and it's so light. And I am just an absolute sucker for a recurve and that kind of, I don't know, it kind of has a barong-shaped blade or a, you know, just like that nice leaf shape. But it doesn't look like the Spyderco leaf shape. It's right. Something different. But what is the Firefly? I'm not remembering what that was.
I don't have one here with me. It's a smaller knife. This is a really early Firefly. All right. Now that is not an Emerson Wave. That is a bottle opener.
Oh, nice.
This is from 2001. So the Firefly had a hole here, you know, the Spyderco Firefly, and it was orange and black.
Okay.
But yeah, this is old, man, 2001, and it's beat up and it's an inset lock too.
Oh, nice.
From long ago.
So tell me about a little bit about your what's happening with Monterey Bay Knives and when that's coming out.
In a few weeks. The next one should be a few weeks. We did the VLD. We did one in carbon fiber. And then we did one in this green canvas material. So this next one will be the third knife we're doing together.
And is it a different design than the VLD? Different blade?
Yeah, different blade shape. So I guess he already showed the thing today, so I can talk about it a little bit, right? It's basically the same handle, but with kind of a nitro blade shape.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah. I'm going to have to get that one. Yeah. I love that nitro blade shape.
Because not everybody likes this super pointy, you know, it's not for everybody, right? So some people like, you know, the nitro style blade, you know, better is probably more useful.
So when the other one, the VLD with the super pointy blade, when that's folded, does that swedge disappear completely in the handle? Because of course I look at that and I think, man, you could sharpen that swedge and that would be pretty cool too.
Well, if it was sharpened, you'd cut yourself.
You'd still cut yourself.
So this is another knife when my son was working with me, him and me designed this.
Ooh.
Little firecracker. He called it the firecracker. Little fixed blade, you know, neck knife.
Yeah.
And we made a ton of those.
It's got the bottle opener again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got the bottle opener. I was actually going to do a deal with Mass Drop, or they call Drop now.
Uh-huh.
And it actually, the project got bounced because another knife maker has a patent on the bottle opener in that position on a blade.
Really?
Even though he patented it in, let's see, I think it was 2007, and this was made in 2001. And Kershaw made a knife years ago, even before I made this one, with a bottle opener in that same spot, and they never patented it, right? Because who patents a bottle opener?
Right.
Nobody.
I think I know. You don't have to say names. But is the knife a folder, a smallish folder?
Yeah, they make a folder and a fixed blade.
Oh, okay.
If you go on Drop's website and just search Kerry, there's a whole little write up on the whole mess.
oh man,
with some explanations on, because it was going to be, you know, it was going to be a good little knife for Drop and me, and you know.
That's a shame.
Didn't happen.
Yeah. So what do you have coming up in the offing that you're excited about?
I'm working on a Tory Mini. I haven't made a Tory for a while. Tory's about a 3.5, 3 5/8 inch blade. So I'm shrinking it down to about a 3 1/8, 3 1/4 maybe. So that's the newest thing I'm working on. Everybody seems to be wanting smaller knives these days. So
that's what I was going to ask you. It seems like there's a real trend, a downsizing trend. And maybe it's the skinny jeans. Maybe it's all the skinny jeans that the hipsters are wearing.
Yeah.
But I mean, I like the big ones. That's kind of my, you know, where my peccadilloes rest. I like them like that. But one thing I wanted to ask you, the fixed blades that are new or are out right now that I saw at Blade, are those 50-50s?
The ones that look kind of like that?
Yes, they look exactly like that.
Okay, well, this is a custom one, but those other ones are actually a production, full production.
So you made the design, you send them to a manufacturer, do you reveal who the manufacturer is of that?
I'm not going to, because they've kind of dissolved, and the two guys running that shop don't get along. And
oh, that sucks.
Split. So no more of those are going to be made.
Ah.
Yeah.
So they were well within grasp.
I know you can get some, though. You can get some from Capital Armory.
Capital Armory.
Capital Armory in right here in Texas, in Austin, Texas. They bought 40 of them. And if we can ever get the rest of the handles machined, they'll have 60 more.
Oh.
So.
I'm writing this down.
Yeah. Capital Armory. They sell suppressors and, you know, class 3 stuff. Very good company.
Do you find that Texas is a better environment for knife making these days or for the kind of things you like?
For like guns, yeah.
For guns, for sure.
They're way more gun friendly than California. I don't think knives, it really matters. But as far as guns and hunting and shooting, Texas is way better than California. You know, when I was younger, we used to be able to just go up in the foothills and set up targets and shoot. And, you know, you can't do that anymore. You know, they started out with no solid projectile zones in California. And so they send out a map, right? Okay, these areas you can't shoot, you know, a solid projectile in. You can use a shotgun. And so every year that map got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and they pushed you farther out in the desert, you know, you couldn't go up in the foothills anymore and shoot. And, you know, they kind of did the same thing with dirt bikes. I was really into dirt bikes as a kid. I got a dirt bike at 13, and you could not keep me off that thing. We could ride, you know, from where I lived, I was kind of like at the edge of town, right? And so almost in the county. And I had to push my bike down the street because my dad wouldn't let me ride it on the street. And so I pushed it down, I hit a field, and then I'd hit the orange groves, and then we'd get through the orange groves, and we'd get into the vineyards. And the vineyards just went for miles and miles all the way up to the foothills. So, you know, we could ride that. We had like a 100-mile loop that we could do. And I was doing this at 13 years old, right?
Wow.
And I'd take a little fanny pack with stuff to fix a flat tire and a little bottle of premix oil, right? Because we didn't have enough gas to get there and back 100 miles. And so we'd ride up through the vineyards, and there was a track, an old abandoned track called Reach Out, motocross track. We'd ride that, and we'd ride up farther, and we'd hit a Royal track, which is now Glen Helen, which is a national motocross track, right? We used to ride that thing for free because it was abandoned also, right? And we'd hit the Santa Ana Wash, and we'd ride the wash up to, and I can't remember what road it is, but the road and the rail tracks, and there was a place called Joe's. It was kind of like a little mom and pop store, and they had burgers and stuff. We'd stop and get a Coke and a burger. And then we'd head up the railroad tracks up to the high desert. And of course, we'd go by the nudist colony, which was right there, and hope that we could see some naked girls riding horses.
Oh, the nudist
colony. Yeah. You know, 13 years old kid, right?
Man.
Interested in all that. So we'd go by the nudist colony and take the railroad tracks up. And then you could ride up to the Summit Trail, which was in the high desert in Southern California, right? And you could, the Summit Trail was like the most awesome trail for a dirt bike. It had some of the biggest hill climbs I've ever seen in my life. And then once you got tired of that, you go up a little bit farther, and it was a gas station, the place you'd get sandwiches, right? So we'd gas up, get a sandwich, and then work our way back home. And it was, you know, it'd take you a long time, you know.
Man, that you just described, like, that sounds just amazing and dreamy. And it sounds like the kind of day a 13-year-old kid, it'd be a lot harder to have that these days.
Oh, yeah. Sure. You can't really do that anymore. So, yeah, it was really, man, it was a great place to grow up, 60s and 70s. And, you know, like I think I told you before that, you know, we could be down at the beach surfing within an hour, you know, from where I lived. And in the wintertime, we could be up in the mountains, up in Big Bear, snow skiing. If the snow was low enough, we could be in Wrightwood in a half hour, you know, from where we lived, snow skiing. So we had all this stuff within, you know, an hour's drive that, you know, different terrain, the desert, the mountains with pine trees and you know, lakes and then the ocean, you know, all within an hour. It was a great place to grow up, especially if you were into surfing and skateboarding and, you know, motorcycles and all that cool stuff.
Let me ask you one last question. If you could have a knife made by anyone, like handmade or whatever, by any one of the knife makers that you admire, who would it be and what would it be?
Oh man, that's too hard. That's a good question. There's too many guys that I really like, you know, and I wouldn't want to hurt anybody's feelings because I want one from so many different people, you know, and I just can't justify spending the kind of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
On some of these customs, I love Michael Raymond's work. Michael Raymond, he's a super good guy. His work is so precise. I mean, his knives are probably as close to perfect anybody's knives I've ever seen. You know, so I admire his work. You know, there's other guys that do, you know, CNC work, like Dmitry Sinkovich, I think that's how you say his name. I mean, that guy is a wizard with a CNC machine. I mean, everything he does is like full-on custom, but it's done with a CNC machine.
And absolutely just beautiful, too. I love his work.
It just blows my mind. And then Edison Barajas, I think is how you say his name. He's just a super cool guy and doing some really neat work these days. You know, but like I said, there's a lot of guys I like. You know, Lee Williams' work. I like the one where he's doing I think he calls it the Iceman, where he's got the mother of pearl in the Timascus scale. It looks like ice, you know.
Ooh, yeah.
I just love that stuff. Like I said, I couldn't pick just one guy.
Yeah, who
there's
can?
Too
who,
many. Yeah.
It's just always interesting to me to find out who people who are at the, man, I mean, you're at the pinnacle of the custom knife making craft. And it's always interesting to me to find out who masters like yourself find to be masters. So
yeah, that's why I asked.
Not to put you on the spot. Well, okay. Yeah. If you're not, you'll do till the real thing gets here, right?
No, you know, I do the best I can. And I think I do all right. But, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that are way better than me, you know, and I love looking at their work and going, I need to do better. You know, you can always do better, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a sign of a master right there. Always. Well,
you know, I mean, that's it.
I'm
always trying to do, you know, make a better knife, make a better design, making something. And I really work to make stuff that I like, right? I'm not trying to make stuff that other people like. I'm trying to make stuff that really thrills me, and hoping that if I like it so much, everybody else is going to like it too, right? And so far, it's worked out pretty good. Some designs that I've made that I really don't care about, like the Roadster, right? The Roadster and the Mini Roadster. I don't like that knife. I designed it. I drew it up. And it's like, it's all right. And I made one and I took it to the show and everybody's like, oh, that's awesome. You know, they thought it was so great. I thought it kind of sucked. Right? So I made another one and you notice I don't make very many, right? And it's because I just don't really care for it that much, but people like it. And a lot of people have made something similar to it. Because people like it so much, and I just don't make many. It's not, you know, my favorite knife. I can make the Scion and the Nitro Mini all day long and be happy just mixing up different materials. Those are two of my favorite knives to make.
Well, we will keep our eye on your Instagram and watch them as you make them slowly but surely. I know you said you're not looking to pump out 100 knives a month, but part of that taking time and taking care in making each one is part of what makes your knives special. So,
yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast, Peter. I really appreciate your time and talking about your knives.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure. Take care.
Took you
sir.
A while to get me on here, didn't it?
It did. It did. But it worked. You know, everything has its time, and I'm really glad it worked out.
Yep, me too. Appreciate it.
All righty, sir. Take care.
Today's podcast is brought to you in part by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/knifejunkie. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Again, that's www.audibletrial.com/knifejunkie.
It's becoming maddening doing this show and meeting people like Peter because I've loved his knives for a long time. And now having spoken with him, now I feel it's a moral imperative to at some point have one of them. Great talking to Peter Carey and great to find out about his evolution from welder to master knife maker. If you're interested in these kind of shows, these kind of interviews, check us out every Sunday right here on the Knife Junkie. And we will have another one fresh for you. Also, we have the Wednesday supplementals. That's where I get a chance to just talk about new knives and the new knives that come through my collection. And of course, always check out Thursday Night Knives and be sure to join us. Join the conversation on your phone or on your device. You can hop right on by going to theknifejunkie.com/join and join the conversation. For Jim working his magic behind the switcher, I'm Bob DeMarco saying we'll see you here next time. And definitely, definitely don't take dull for an answer.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.